Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
This episode is brought to you by Jack Henry Digital, the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community financial institutions translate their trust and live, local, personal service meaningfully into digital channels for the first time. Inclusion, exclusion, diversity and equity, creating access, embedding education to close gaps, and the need to bridge the digital divide are conversations we've had on this show over the last 7 years. We've tried to highlight the personal stories and passions of those trying to rewrite our future, whether that is climate change, inclusion, or the democratization of finance. Today, we're going to bring in sharp focus the stories of two individuals doing this for the Black community in the U.S. This is the story of two Black bankers. I've asked my good friend Randy Rivera to co-host the first segment. Randy is the co-founder of the RegTech CoinTech, executive director of the FinTech's nonprofit, and principal of Keen Advisors. Randy spent close to two decades at JPMorgan Chase and BBVA, and Randy is also Latino. This is no way meant to compare the Black and the Brown experience, but something I've learned over the years is I have significant blind spots based on my experience. Randy and I have had many discussions about race and social justice over the years, and I know that his journey through banking can help us take this conversation deeper than I would be able to myself. Our first guest is David Clooney, executive director of the Black Economic Alliance, the nation's only coalition of business leaders and aligned advocates committed to economic progress and prosperity in the Black community, with specific focus on work, wages, and wealth. David was also at JPMorgan Chase, where he was a senior member of the Corporate Responsibility Committee. Prior to joining JPMorgan Chase, David was the executive director of the U.S. Department of the Treasury, deputy associate counsel at the White House, and a litigator in private practice. In the second half, we have Tyrone Ross. He is the director of community at Altruis, an RIA, and a host of the Human Advisor podcast. He's been recognized by Investment News 40 Under 40 for 2019, and WealthManagement.com named him as a top 10 advisor. According to Planning.com, he's one of 20 people who will change wealth management in 2020. David, congratulations on working in, or maybe rather through, the trifecta of three of the whitest, malest, and stalest industries: banking, politics, and law. I'd like to start by asking, which was the hardest from a race perspective? If you can actually kind of say, you know, maybe it's the which is the loser of this horrible race.
Is there a D, all of the above option?
Yeah.
So out of the three, financial services is probably the worst, very closely followed by law, very closely followed by politics. They all suffer from both pipeline and culture problems. So they're all pretty bad.
Why do you think we have this gap, right? It's a known issue, getting talent in the door and retaining it. Like, this has been, you know, well documented and publicized. How come we haven't been able to solve that?
So I'll talk about both the pipeline issue and the kind of internal opportunities, mobility, upward mobility issue. I think on the pipeline issue, well, let me say this, both are impacted by unconscious and implicit bias against Black people, full stop. There have been studies done where it is well documented that if you give people the same resumes with different names on them, all of the information being equal, one, you know, person's name is Jamal, one person's name is Jason, there are, you know, different results, patently different results, with the less Black sounding name having, you know, better performance or better reception from different people. So I think one of the good conversations we're having now at the current moment of, you know, national reckoning around race and what it has meant throughout the entire, you know, history of the United States is that there are impacts of systemic racism and unconscious and implicit in a lot of cases bias that are tied to race. So I think on the pipeline side, what you can add to that is a lot of the people in power are not people of color, particularly not Black people. So, you know, pipelines are often formed by where people, where they went to school, their own networks, who they associate with. So a lot of those things have excluded Black people, and in some cases, you know, not intentionally, but I've seen successful, and very few, but successful efforts to counteract that are essentially sourcing Black people. You know, one of the things that I think my old firm did very well was create a program to have an ongoing full-time sourcing program where you are pulling in more and more Black people to a pool and essentially saying these are qualified Black people who can work in different parts of this organization. And in some cases, they're cultivated for over a year before they're placed. But there was a very specific, very targeted effort at going to non-traditional sources, whether it's different schools you haven't gone to, different organizations, different parts of the country. And that is absolutely necessary. If we continue like the status quo of just going to what we know and who we know. And I've had this conversation with white male supervisors who say, I'm tired of getting, you know, lacrosse players from Connecticut because that's right. all I know. And that's who I am. And that's what I keep filling my team with. And I want something else. Can you help me? So then the flip side of that on the culture side is, you know, who people relate to, who the managers relate to, who they take to lunch, who they go to happy hour with, who they play golf with, again, often excludes Black people. In many cases, so, that is not intentional, but it has an impact.
So, David, so this is interesting because there's a couple. First of all, you and I connected through, like, through the source was Jack and Jill.
Yes.
Right. Good friend of mine, best man, introduced me to you. And, you know, programs like Jack and Jill, which are designed to create kind of that a strong network to help accelerate the lift up. Right. That's the design of it. That clearly we haven't seen significant improvement. I mean, we've seen change, but it's at the end of the day, the numbers are the numbers and they kind of spell out what they are. Let's talk about that, right? Because I think, do you, first, honestly, do you think these programs are working anymore? Or, because I've heard some people, particularly people that are in the African, leaders in the African American community saying that this crutch needs to be taken away. So I'd love your response to that. And secondly, on the cultural side, can you maybe speak to someone that didn't come with those? I mean, obviously, David, you've accomplished a ton. You're a smart man, hardworking, all those things that got you to where you are. But you and I both know there's a lot of people that look like us that are equally as smart, equally as maybe even are more hardworking, have the desire, but they hit the limits. Maybe you, over the course of your career, would love a perspective where you say, look, here's, you don't have to give me names, obviously, because not that many of us, I don't want you to out any friends. But the reality is we've seen situations where the two talent pools are the same. They should end up at the same point. If you're of color, the chances of probability is much significantly lower. So love your thoughts on that.
Great question. So on the first one, there's absolutely still a need for targeted programs at offsetting the natural status quo of you not having a pipeline and a culture that is conducive to Black people succeeding and being promoted. So you absolutely have a need for it. What I do think we need to do differently is stop just, you know, putting somebody in charge of diversity and inclusion that is often a Black woman and say, okay, you fix it for us. What we need to do is have conversations with and among, and sometimes only among white men and people who represent the majority and have them challenge each other's notions, experiences, and share best practices with each other about what things have worked, what hasn't worked. You obviously need people at the table, but one of the big problems is you have one person at the table. You have one Black person at the table who now has these 10 extra jobs. And I've had this experience in every single job I've had, where you have to be the voice of Black America while overperforming in your job to have an opportunity to move up. Because I'll also say, I think a different set of standards are applied. You know, I was taught from a very young age, you have to work twice as hard to do half as well. And I've applied that throughout my career. So to your second point about, you know, how am I different and why did I get opportunities and maybe some other people didn't? I have been the beneficiary of good timing in a lot of places in my career. I think one of the things you talked about Jack and Jill earlier, I think one of the things I learned at a very early age was dual consciousness, was something W.E.B. Du Bois talks about, basically Black people being able to speak two languages and be very much at home among Black people, but also, you know, not be threatening and speak a language that people receive well outside of our community. And I think I learned to do that at a very young age, and working in politics helps, so working in law helps, persuasive, you know, speaking and argument making, but also meeting people where they are. So I think that has been a differentiator in my career. And I've also been lucky enough to be tied to some folks who have given me opportunities. But I am absolutely the exception, not the rule. And I can think about a number of occasions where, you know, people have come to me, be they Black or white, in my different parts of my career and say, hey, I want to be where you are. How do I get there? And I'll often, you know, give examples of the things that work, but I'll also often talk about why my situation is different than a typical person. And unfortunately, it is often not a model. The people who, you know, are the examples of where you want to be, they're often, you know, things that you can't, it's not an easy model to follow, unfortunately. Right.
Rosabeth Moss Kantor at Harvard Business School did some research on this. It wasn't race-related, but I think it's really germane to what you were just saying. She was studying women achieving within sales, specifically within kind of big tech. And this is, I think, late 80s, early 90s, right? So selling hardware and stuff. And the company she studied, you know, said, you know, we need, you know, more women and, you know, diversity in this case based on gender involved in the show. They added, and it didn't work. And so she was brought in to figure out what didn't work. And what she found was their approach was, is they got a woman in each office, right? And of something like, you know, they had 100 offices or something like that. And what happened when you don't have critical concentration, you actually found that the women actually morphed to the white male dominated culture that was that sales force, and they therefore didn't perform as well. And it was everything from they felt to the need to be one of the boys, and they would be harder on other women, you know, and things like this. And that resonates with me. And what you're just saying is, until we reach some level of critical concentration, that if it's only about the David Clooney's who are the exceptional doing, you know, twice as much work to get half as far, and you're the one who breaks through, until we really break down that you don't have to be the exception, that the rule is actually a more accurate representation. Like, this engine just doesn't turn over on itself, right? Like, it always right. will be forced some way. How do we start to make that change? Like, if you could be given a blank slate, you know, how do you think we begin to rebuild this?
So let me first start by thanking you for bringing that up and saying, you know, there have been studies done to show, with respect to interviewing in particular, if you have a slate of candidates, let's call it 5 candidates, and one candidate is other than the rest, if you have 4 white men and 1 white woman, or 4 men and 1 woman, 4 you know, white men, 1 black man, whatever it is, the one who is other, their chances of being hired are slim to none. And the more you diversify that pool, the higher the chances of the person or a group of people who are other than increases in their chances of success. I would apply the same model to the culture of different organizations and saying, if you're the one person who is other than, you just made the example, I think folks, you know, will sometimes feel the need to overcompensate, and they are, you know, it's too risky for them to be the voice of, you know, their one, whatever they represent that is not like the others. So, excuse me, they can be more critical of folks from their own, you know, background, or, you know, kind of think that a different set of standards apply to those folks. So I think how we change it is being, one, just being honest about the reality. I think one of the things we've done to our detriment is talk about diversity and inclusion as this overly encompassing, like, everybody who is not a white male, Anglo-Saxon, you know, Catholic male is diverse. And you count these numbers in the aggregate and you say, we're awesome. We have 75%, you know, diverse people on our board and our senior leadership. We're great. My old financial firm split this up and disaggregated those numbers and said, whoa, we have a real problem with black people, among others. But black people were, you know, the numbers were stark in terms of just the disparity between the two. So I think looking at the numbers of who is impacted and how, but also being honest that this is an industry-wide problem. This is not a company-specific problem. I think companies are very embarrassed about that they're not further along down the road than they are. But I think the current moment, again, provides an opportunity for us to take a systemic look at this and say, these are cultural issues that are not specific to one or two people. And this is, you know, these pieces of institutional racism that are impacting and producing these numbers are not intentional acts of, you know, certain hiring managers. It is a system of perceptions of black people that, you know, unfortunately have not moved past a place where black people are seen as less than, other than, and not as smart or not as good. So I think being honest about those perceptions and being very targeted in how you try to counteract them is very important. And that's not just in hiring, but that's also in culture of your organization. And that's also in, you know, how you are cultivating talent. So I think one of the places, one of the many places institutional and structural racism shows up is in things like succession plans and feedback, where on one hand, you have a lot of managing or supervisors afraid to give black people the same type of feedback they give others because they don't want to be, you know, they don't want to come off as racist. But then they also, at the same time, when they're applying standards of, you know, who can get promoted and how, the standards are often very different and much higher. And you have to be Barack Obama in order, you know, you have to be perfect in every way in order to even be considered for promotion or for a succession plan.
Well, this is interesting, David, because it reminds me of, you know, I was blessed enough to come into a training program with a lot of exposure to senior management and did rotational work for my first job. But then I had to eventually pick a permanent home, and I was a commercial lender focused on small and mid-sized businesses, right? And I had a, you know, my manager and I have a really good relationship. And, you know, he hired me because he knew that I could do the job well. He knew that I had the skills. He knew that I worked hard, right? So I gave him a tremendous outcome and performance. But then in hindsight, to hit on this note that you're bringing up, I was the only Hispanic and Spanish-speaking banker in the Midwest covering, you know, so what ends up happening is because of that, and, you know, we onboarded Spanish-speaking clients and Spanish-owned businesses, but I had to do that and then also tell the people no, because, you know, as we know historically, these communities are not, they have not been well resourced. So not all businesses are going to succeed. So I had to do that work as well as the training of the financial institution around, let me translate, and this is not for Spanish to English, it's cultural translation around what this business does, what is risky in this business, what is not. And I found myself doing that a lot. And I think that it's challenging, especially in light with when you have these people of color come into these roles, if they individually don't have that cultural context. You know, I'm curious from your perspective, in this time of COVID, for example, you know, you were in Harlem, I'm in Chicago, but as you and I joked around when we were talking together the other day, a lot of the people that are during this time are leaving to go somewhere else, and business relationships, personal relationships are being created. So how do we counterbalance that? Because the reality is, as we look forward in the next 12 to 18 months, you have people on different kinds of islands building different types of bonds, which will create a lot more opportunities, again, for an insular network. What are your thoughts on, you know, as you talk to your business leaders and what they're doing to offset that?
So I think one of the things that's important to do is be, again, intentional about offsetting and counteracting the status quo. So I think that's doing things like going to people who are not necessarily in positions of leadership, but who, you know, show traits of leadership and bring different perspectives, and asking them to enlighten, you know, the rest of the group on, you know, something they didn't know, inviting different perspectives into the conversation. And we even talked about this at my old job. Basically, you know, we looked around the management table and said, there's not enough diversity around here. I was the only managing director, Black managing director in the United States in my group, and I was one of two in my entire group. And there was an acknowledgement by the leadership, to their credit, that that was not good enough, and they needed to bring in people, you know, who were not just of a certain level of seniority, but who represented certain perspectives. So I think it's being very intentional about offsetting the imbalance and looking at the imbalance and offsetting the imbalance by inviting and kind of putting forward and promoting different perspectives so that you don't have the same people leading the conversation all the time. But I think that managers also need to be sensitive to the burden they're putting on the one or two or very few people who represent, you know, underrepresented groups, and exactly what they're asking them to do. Because while, you know, again, I'll say, I think a different set of standards are often applied to those folks. So they have a lot of work to do in their day job, but then they, you know, nobody's keeping tabs in many cases on all of the side jobs they're doing with, you know, not only their kind of by name and title, you know, sitting on the diversity committee, sitting on the equity and inclusion working group, now the racial equity funds that are being set up in different places, which is great, you know, advising the leadership on diversity, equity, and inclusion, although they have no experience in this area of work other than their lived experience of being that, you know, that type of person or being from an underrepresented group. So I think it's being very specific about how you were bringing those opinions in, but also making sure that you are not overburdening the people who represent underrepresented groups.
So it's interesting, Jason, when you ask what you can do in terms of really trying to help make real change and progress, I recently shared a TED Talk that America Ferrera did last year on, the title of it is My Identity is a Superpower. And it really, it was a good opportunity for me. It was great. I recommend that you listen to it if you can. But what it did was something that I think is important. It walks through her journey of her identification and growing as an actress and what people wanted her to play versus what she wanted to do. But eventually got her to the point to help her accept who she is. And, you know, I talk a lot about my daughter who's it's a junior in high school, 17 years old, and she has embraced her curls. And she's got an interesting background because she's of light complexion. Some people don't necessarily know she's Dominican and Puerto Rican, but one of the things that I think is important that needs to get done is an ownership of that difficult conversation and embracing of the discipline of having those difficult conversations. Because for people like me, that is a regular exercise that I partake in every single day. And so one of the questions that I had for you in closing, David, was maybe you can walk us through the business case is clearly there and everybody agrees on that. But what is the emotional case? How do you get people comfortable with that very tough feeling that comes up every time you bring up a conversation about equity and diversity? What is the emotional case to take on these hard conversations on a consistent basis?
So great question. The emotional case for business leaders, like you said, the business case is there. You need more diverse perspectives represented to have better, to make better decisions and have better outcomes for your business, for your bottom line. The emotional case is, even if you didn't want to do this, you have to do it because your stakeholders are requiring you to do it. And your stakeholders are your clients, your shareholders, your customers, but particularly your employees. And if you are not creating an environment that is not only inclusive, but comfortable for people to be who they are comfortably and share and not feel like they have to assimilate and kind of walk in line in order to succeed, which is still happening in a lot of cases, you will continue to have the same results. So I think one of the things I suggest actually is that companies be more forthcoming about disclosing their numbers. And this is something that Dan Shulman from PayPal has been a leader on, you know, putting up your not only diversity numbers, but how many Black people you have on your board of directors and your senior leadership that's in your C-suite within two levels of management from your leadership, the pay gap between your Black employees and your white employees. And I say those two groups very intentionally because I think that's where the largest gap exists. If we make this an industry-wide, sector-wide,
David, don't get too nervous. We're not far behind you. The Hispanic population in compensation is not too far behind the African American disparity. Just want
to
make sure
that is a great point. So I think you need to break it down by group and compare everybody to your white employees, Hispanic employees to white employees, women to men, Black to white, you know, Black to Hispanic, everybody to Asian, so on and so forth. So I think you have to be better than just saying, oh, our diverse folks are doing great. It is break it down and see where your problems are. But I think it is no longer accepting the status quo. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, we try to hire people of color. We put one Black person on a slate and they didn't get hired, or we brought one Black person in and they just didn't, you know, succeed. There has to be more. I think the critical concentration we talked about earlier is a huge part of it, but it is really a culture shift and a culture change. So I think we're having and starting the right conversations now, but we have a really long way to go.
I mean, that idea of breaking it down, you know, kind of, you know, putting my CEO hat on, at first seems super uncomfortable, right? Because it's calling out an individual and, you know, a case could be made in that discomfort to say, oh, that doesn't seem fair to be singling the Black people out like that, you know, to kind of show that. But unless we actually do and really shine the light on it, how can we actually, you know, level this up across the board? Like, you know, it really does need that level of scrutiny across. And I hadn't thought about just how we kind of miss the broader point because we bundle it all under the guise of inclusivity, because that seems, you know, somehow more noble and the right thing to do. But that kind of gloss over, unfortunately, is glossing over the heart of the problem you have there.
That's right. That's right. And I think one of the things, if you have more buy-in and take-up from more, you know, participants in the market, you will see that this is a systemic problem. So one of the things that we need to get past is white guilt. There's a lot of white guilt about, you know, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to call people out. I don't want to be called racist, or I don't want to have to defend why I'm not racist. It's less about that. It is more about the system that, you know, still is not conducive to success for certain types of people. And I think if we show that this is a problem across the board and not from one or two companies, that helps us have a conversation about how we change it systematically.
Yeah. And Jason, so it's a great point, David. And one of the things that I told a recent friend who called me and the gist of the call was, I'm not racist. I don't think, help me understand what I can do, right? Or help me understand this. I just don't know what to do. And because I feel like guilty calling you because you're my brown friend, right? And I was like, okay, let me give you a simple example. And I think most people that can relate to this one, if you live in a condo association, right? And it's a small one, like 12 units. There are generally about a third of the units that will never care to pay or make investments in anything that's not an immediate pressing need, right? And I think if you think about what we're doing, it's just, we've done in America for 400 years, is we haven't done the basic work of redoing the roof on a consistent basis. We haven't done the upkeep. We have had the hard conversations around what do we do to make the building sustain overall. Now we have to pay for it. And this payment is an emotional one. It's difficult. So, you know, Jason, you talk a lot about innovation theater in the fintech space. In this case, you got to be careful about diversity theater too. And I think there's a very analogous to kind of what the situation is, where the real talk right now is great. The real action is what I think is going to make the big difference. And people just have to get comfortable with the fact that since you haven't made the investment over time to build, you know, to have this conversation and equipped the society to do so, it's just going to be a little bit more difficult to actually achieve the outcomes that we want, because we have to get to the hard steps first, which is having people actually accept this is all a real problem for everyone.
Yeah. You know, without that, we didn't talk a lot about, you know, David's day job today, which is being the CEO of the Black Economic Alliance, which works to really drive outcomes in three areas: work, wages, and wealth. And I would say, you know, those are places where there are big gaps. And unfortunately, he should probably also be adding, you know, the tech gap, the education gap, the healthcare gap, you know, universally. But unless we start solving some of the problems at the top within the corporate, specifically because banking, financial services, fintech, we touch all of this. If we don't actually solve our diversity and equity problem and our gap problem there, we probably can't roll that out across the board and drive the systemic change across, you know, all of these gaps that David talks about. And so if you want to learn more about what the Black Economic Alliance does, it's blackeconomicalliance.org. David, we'll probably have to do another show where we actually just talk about what you guys do, because it is very interesting and very important. But I want to thank both David Clooney and Randy Rivera for taking their time out to have some of the hard conversations, especially on such a beautiful day when we're recording.
Thank you, Jason. And thank you, Randy. I appreciate you guys having me, and I'd love to be back.
This episode is brought to you by Jack Henry Digital, the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community financial institutions translate their trust and live, local, personal service meaningfully into digital channels for the first time. Jack Henry Digital helps community financial institutions strategically differentiate their digital offerings from those megabanks, big techs, and fintechs. So how did they do it? With the Banno Digital Platform, a complete 100% API-enabled open digital banking platform. You get beautiful, lightning-fast native apps and integrated PFM for your customers and members, and cloud-based, core-connected back-office tools for your employees. And with website marketing and content management capabilities built in, community banks and credit unions can create, launch, and track targeted campaigns quickly from click-through to product acquisition across all digital channels. My favorite part of the platform is Banno Conversations, a first-of-its-kind, fully authenticated, secure chat capability that puts branch staff front and center in real time at the moment of need, extending the relationship-based banking model and restoring community financial institutions' ability to sell in the context of live digital service. You really have to see this feature to fully understand its potential. Visit banno.com to schedule a demo today. That's BANNO.com. Is your razor in quarantine? I can assure you mine is not. I look in horror at some of these Zoom calls and see Grizzly Adams sitting across from me. In fact, I think a few people have been cheating and started growing their facial hair in advance of the stay-at-home orders. So what do? I use Harry's. Why? Because razors are very expensive, and cheap ones, well, they hurt. And this is where Harry's comes in. They build some of the best blades in the industry, and they've done it by cutting out the middleman, manufacturing their blades in their German blade factory that's been honing precision blades for a century, which means you get an incredibly high quality blade at factory direct prices, just $2 per blade. And the direct is also an important aspect and benefit right now. Those refills can arrive straight at your doorstep on a schedule, with or without a subscription. I love what the company stands for too. Already they were donating 1% of proceeds being put aside for nonprofit organizations devoted to helping provide access to better healthcare for men and veterans. And to help those in need right now, Harry's is donating $1 million worth of shaving supplies to hospitals across the U.S. Listeners of the Breaking Bank show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/fintech. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with alloy to keep your skin hydrated, and when we can actually travel again, a blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/fintech to start shaving better today.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
Our next guest is Tyrone Ross. Planning.com says Tyrone is one of 20 people who will change wealth management in 2020. He was one of Investment News's 40 Under 40 for 2019, and WealthManagement.com named him a top 10 advisor. This segment is brought to you by Blueleaf.com. Access to high-quality financial advice is a global challenge and is a significant contributor to the wealth gap. Blueleaf helps financial advisors serve clients of all sizes by decreasing the time and cost to service a client. Providing high-touch service to smaller clients is not only possible, it's profitable. The combination of machine learning, sophisticated automation, and beautiful, simple design in client communications and reporting, as well as back office functions like rebalancing, trading, and billing, eliminates most of the incremental costs of a new client or better servicing your existing clients. Visit blueleaf.com to learn more. Tyrone, I'm curious, when I was little, I either wanted to be a cowboy or a firefighter. Still kind of a mystery to me how I ended up, you know, in the financial service industry for almost three decades now. So I'm curious, when did you realize you wanted to be a financial advisor?
I never wanted to be one. Like most financial advisors, I fell into this profession. I'm a serial failure. When I grew up, I wanted to be an Olympian, but I introduced myself as a three-time failed Olympian. So, you know, because I failed at that, my dream is never going to come true. It led me to, you know, financial services, and here I am. But I didn't wake up one day and say, man, I want to be a financial advisor. So it's been a very circuitous route that we could talk about. But yeah, my thing was to become an Olympian, not a financial advisor.
Which Olympic events did you fail at?
The 400 meters. So I qualified originally in 2004 for the Olympic trials, and then was short in 08, and then tore my groin 2 weeks before the Olympic trials in 2012.
You know, that is, I would not consider a failure. I would call that the near miss in terms of the reality. If you want to talk about, you know, the Olympic failures, we could talk about my athletic career. Have you ever regretted it? If you ever woke up and thought, oh man, you know what, lawyer, maybe even cowboy would have been a better choice.
No, I don't regret it. What I do regret is not being a little bit easier on myself during the journey and enjoying it, because I'll never have it again. But I was very, very, very hard on myself and very, very hard on other people because I was so driven. I was maniacally driven to achieve it. So I just, if I went back, I would be a little bit nicer to myself and nicer to the people around me.
Well, I think that's sage advice for everyone. And, you know, since this is a podcast, no one can see, but you're black. And while, you know, not long ago, I wouldn't have mentioned that because we try not, you know, to highlight that. We appreciate diversity, but this is an episode talking about some hard things. And in doing the research for the show, part of what came up is, you know, people of color make up less than 4% of certified financial planners in the US, which was just astounding to me. And that's people of color, that's blacks and Latinos, right? So when you break that apart, you've risen, you know, to the top of a field that, you know, the numbers would say, wow, you are the top of the top of the top. And so I want to talk about three things today: the advisor gap, why this exists, the wealth and income gap that we see in this country, and the structural gap. So from your experience and looking around, you know, and working with so many other advisors, why do you think there's such a gap in minority representation?
So I want to go back to something you said. You didn't have to announce me as black. Kendrick Lamar has a line in the song, I'm black is the name, Tyrone and Darius. So if they didn't know I was Black from my name, they need to find some new listeners.
Yes.
The funny thing about that is, though, it leads right into your question, because when I started on Wall Street, they told me that I would never be successful unless I told people that my name was Tyler when I called them, because Tyrone was too Black. So that's why there
explicitly told you that.
Told to my face, if you want to be successful on Wall Street and calling people, as cold calling time said, tell them your name is Tyler, not Tyrone. To my face. Now, I was a younger man then, and I handled it differently than I would handle it right now. But that was a very hurtful thing. And I think that's a lot of that. That is indicative as to why there are not a lot of Black financial advisors in this business. I also want to make the distinction between Black and brown. This is a Black issue going on in America now, not a brown one. Everybody that's brown doesn't have the Black experience. The first thing. Second thing is the reason why there's not more CFPs, more Series 7s, more CFAs, because Wall Street hasn't acknowledged its history. There's no such thing as Black Wall Street. Wall Street has been Black since day one. Slaves dug it up and built it and were turned around and sold as the first commodity on Wall Street, so much so that our government in 1711 said New York City is the hub for all things slaves. You want them tall, dark, short, fat, skinny? Run on down to New York City. That's where you go. It's the epicenter for all things slavery. So until Wall Street acknowledges that history, it's a no-go, because I am out here and others that are Black advisors don't realize that. And that we are out here perpetuating a fraud to the young community and the young folks that we're trying to lure into an industry that have lied to us.
How aware of that were you? Because one, I love history, and I was very aware of, the fact of slave labor. Hadn't thought of, just candidly, the fact that, yes, I intellectually knew, slaves were treated as commodities, one of the first commodities. That just, makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up to think about it. Like, what was the experience like knowing that as a Black man to go work on Wall Street?
It's funny, I did not know it. And it took me a while. It was a book I read, Why Wall Street Matters. And okay. I was like, oh my God, I was unaware of this. I did not know that history, because you are raised in Black America. We need a Black Wall Street. No. Wall Street is Black through and through. It had always been, right? We built it and then they sold us. And oh, by the way, they only stopped selling slaves in New York City once they found a commodity that was more lucrative and cleaner, hello, coffee, right? So these are things that we need to learn that needs to be in the CFP manual, whatever else. And when we go into schools and we can stop, Black history is American history, and that history of Wall Street needs to be known. And if that is the case, then more Black people will say, whoa, you know what? Really? Had no idea. So something that we feel like we're shut out of. Wait, we've actually built, like Wall Street was built on the back of people that are Black. That history has to be reconciled. Now, I think the more timely and effective answer that people, or PC answer now that people want to do it is we need to market. The imagery in this business is awful. We need to market to the demographic that we're trying to go. Historically Black colleges. I would be curious if any financial advisor, anyone in financial services can name three. Delaware State has one of the best PFP programs in the country. Wealthmanagement.com said so. What great Wall Street firm goes and recruits at Delaware State? I'll wait. So these are the things that, again, when I left Merrill, there were 14,000 advisors, 100 of color. Merrill's a 100-year-old firm. That's one per year.
I'm curious. So is that way? Did people not go to Merrill, or did people opt out of Merrill? Because there's two issues, and it's probably some of both, right? Because you're talking about there's an intake problem. If you are not, going to Howard, Delaware State, and some of these historically Black but programs that are phenomenal, you're going to end up with you're just fishing in the wrong ponds to have any hope of ending up diverse, right, at the intake. I'm still stunned by what you said of being told that your name, you should introduce yourself as Tyler, because I could think as, you know, a young person, I could see a lot of people, you know, certainly people who have less tenacity than you saying, you know what, maybe this isn't the place for me. Is it a one problem or both problem? Like, have we started to fix either one of them?
Yeah, no, I think that happens a lot. I think there are a lot of, whether it's at Merrill or other places, they opt out. They're just like, I don't want to put up with this. And that was, it's funny, that was early in my career. Some of the racism and bigotry that I experienced after that, woo, like just simply telling me to change my name was disrespectful, but calling me an N-word repeatedly to my face and you being rewarded for that by going to a bigger branch with more advisors is kind of like, all right, we already know what it is. And not only did you call me an N-word to my face, but you dragged lesbians into it. You dragged Hispanic folks, everybody, right to my face. And you were rewarded with going to a bigger branch with more advisors and all of your privilege. This industry does a really good job of letting us know how they feel about us. So yes, the unicorns that survive in this business, like myself, have endured a lot, a lot, a lot of bigotry, a lot of racism, a lot of hatred, a lot of, again, structural things that are set up against us so that we do not survive. And to be honest, a lot of Black advisors at the wirehouses don't survive because they don't get the transfer of assets that happened internally, and they're not high on those lists because you got to be high on the AUM to get some of the assets that are thrown around. If not, they don't trickle down to you. So yes, I want to make it very clear, it's twofold. But when you have a small pool and then some of that pool opts out, it's hard to grow that number. It's hard to grow that top line number. So it is structural. And I'm going to make this very clear. The issue in this country is systemic, which is hundreds of years in the making. We're not going to fix that in 2020. We're not going to fix that on this podcast. The structural piece, you're damn right, could be fixed. And our business can start with that. And it is structural in this country. If we don't change those structures, we don't change the pipeline. And then we don't get to the whole thing of fixing the pipeline issue and ultimately retention.
Well, if we don't start talking about the structural things and making them more apparent, you know, like the AUM example, it could be very easy for someone who is not Black looking at that and saying, oh, it happened because of this, this, and this, and miss this underlying thing that you had just pointed out, which is there's a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you start with, you know, more white kids coming into the business, working on teams that are largely white, and, you know, without thinking about it, you know, getting closer to the people who act more like them. So if you're working for a senior broker at a wirehouse who has more AUM, well, guess what? Now you're starting to get more AUM naturally. And as you've kind of risen up in that rank on the list, like you said, the self-fulfilling prophecy is, hey, when there's the transfer of assets, guess who's getting that, right? Mm-hmm. Like the problem was set up. And if you don't call out that structural thing that set it off, it's very mm-hmm. easy to miss the root of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's my simplistic. Now, I want to get into part of how this impacts clients. How do you think about, you know, being a Black advisor? How does that change either who you serve or how you serve them? And then in a second, I'm going to ask the flip side. You know, if you were a recipient of the financial advice, how does that impact you, the color of the advisor giving it to you?
So that, again, when you look at being, it depends on where you are. If you are an independent advisor, you have more control over the demographic you want to help.
Yeah.
When you are at a wirehouse and they tell you that clients have to have a net worth, right, of a certain amount or assets of 250,000, if you come from where I come from and grew up how I grew up, you don't have anybody around you that has $250,000. So you're not even prospecting in an area of people who look like you. And then you're dealing with people, right? I tell this example all the time. I had a client, older white woman. She got off the elevator and she's like, Tyrone, I was in Newark last night. Newark is the largest city in New Jersey, mostly Black population. And she said, two Black men got off the elevator and I immediately got off. I was terrified. At that moment, I realized her comfort was in the brand, not me. So as long as Merrill Lynch was on her statement, I could have been a gecko and she was okay with me managing her money. That's the comfort in the brand.
Yeah.
And it's still, again, racism. It's not overt, but it's, again, that structural piece of what that branding that people are made to believe. Now, when you are a black advisor at these firms and you're used to being patted on your head and you're the token Negro, right? That it's, you know, you may be on an all-white team or you may be just getting by. There's this juxtaposition of not working with people who look like you, not serving people who work like you, and then leaving that and then having to go into a community with people who need your services. It's a sickening feeling, but you can't help them because your job says they're not worthy of that time and attention. Now, on the flip side, if I'm the end client and I'm looking for somebody who looks, walk, talks, and acts like me, if I walk into a room and I know you look like me, the trust thing that this business is put on, I immediately lower that barrier to entry. I trust you, right? Yeah. You're a black male, you're a black woman, you're a Hispanic woman, I trust you. What is it that you have to say? Now I gain more credibility because you trust me. And anything that then comes out of my mouth, you're more than likely to take action on. Whereas opposed to if I walk into a room full of white men with suits and I'm a black woman, that's the token diversity and inclusion hire. Diversity and inclusion is a trope, by the way. Yeah. Anyway, I'll get to that. If she's the token diversity and inclusion hire, she goes, here's what we need to do. And then they all look at her like, right? You're a figurehead. Yep. You don't matter. It's the same thing with it. It's the same thing working with clients in that same vein. They are not going to feel comfortable working with people who don't look like them. And people should have a choice. We just don't provide them that choice.
Yeah. So get into the trope about diversity and inclusion. Why is it just a trope? Is it because the tokenism attached to it? If we don't actually put someone in charge of it, though, if we don't actually, you know, what gets measured is what gets managed. If we don't actually put efforts against it, how do we change it?
Well, I mean, it's a trope because diversity now, well, first of all, we never defined what diversity and inclusion was. Let's, again, true. Said you like history. Let's go back to history. Diversity and inclusion was instituted so that European folks in the workplace were comfortable working with blacks. Now you're diverse if you hire a white woman. That's the truth. The statistics bear out that the greatest benefit from diversity and inclusion have been white women. Right? Sonia Dreisler talks about this. She's a white woman. Yep. Like, these are the facts. So it has gotten away from its sole purpose. Now, if we move towards representation and equality, now we're cooking with fish grease, as my mother would say, right? Everyone is represented. Everyone gets an equal shot. Now we're talking. Diversity and inclusion has simply just become this term that no one could define. And it's clear that it hasn't worked. It hasn't worked. It
got so watered down. I think
it hasn't worked.
The representation and equality, that has real measure that you can put to it.
Yes.
Right. You know, back to the what gets measured gets managed comment is, you're right, diversity, inclusion, you know, so if I take what is diverse enough or inclusive enough, if I take a smattering of people of different sexual orientation, sprinkle in a little bit of color, make sure I have a few women, you can't measure that. But you can if you put it against the bar of representation.
So I want to be very clear. I'm not against diversity and inclusion if it's defined, because by the way, there are black men who didn't grow up the way I grew up. They went to Wharton. They went to Kellogg. They went to private schools. I didn't. I was the first generation high school graduate in my family. So you need diverse background. You need diverse culture. You need diverse language. You need diverse all of these things. I'm not diversity and inclusion, but that paired with a representative set of people that have an equal shot to be the CEO. Now we're really getting into some true structural change.
Well, let's talk about some of the structural issues. And I'm sure you're aware of this, that Marilyn Booker, who headed diversity and inclusion at Morgan Stanley for 16 years, was fired at the end of last year. And she's now actually filing suit claiming it was retaliatory for continuing to push programs that would help more black advisors be successful. Where else do you see the structural barriers?
The structural barriers. So one is the access, right? I talk about three things: exposure, education, and empowerment. Access, exposure, that first E. There isn't enough exposure to what it means to even be banked in this country. 70% of black communities don't have a bank branch.
Yep.
That's just simply access. Structural, the education piece. when you look at only
on that, not only is it the 70% don't have the branch, 17% of Blacks, according to a McKinsey study, are completely disconnected from the banking system.
Of course.
Forget about having a branch. I mean, completely disconnected. Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. And you start to look at the unbanked ranks or whatever. The South Bronx, not close to where I, you know, not too far from where I sit, is the poorest congressional district in the country. Half of the people there don't have a bank account. Right. Like that is glaring. Right. The median net worth of a Black family in Boston is $8. Like these are things that need to be addressed. And you look at it all starts with that. The banking deserts, the inability to bank yourself. Then you start to get into the access of how do I acquire the education to even get myself out of this? It's not there. It's not accessible. So that's the second E. The last E is the empowerment piece. Our business, right, and I say our financial services, will go into these communities for a little while. We'll hold our little conferences. We do all of these things. We'll take a picture with the little Black kid in front of the school with the new laptops we brought. We go away. There's no continued empowerment. There's no continued endowment. There's no continued resource generation, networking, mentorship, sponsorship for these communities so that as we pull them into the banking system and ultimately into becoming financially literate and educated, that we then say, here are resources as you start to graduate and matriculate through your financial life. We haven't done that. So when you do that, you leave out a whole bunch of people that then aren't even exposed to what it means that, again, half of America have access to.
I think we focus too much on your middle E. Right. We always talk about financial 100%. Literacy. We want to do the education. And then, you know, Jennifer Tesher, the CEO of the Financial Health Network, right? You would think if anyone was a big proponent of financial literacy, it would be her. But she points out time and time again, it's an absolute failure and a waste of money. But what I'm hearing from you is we're missing the front end and the back end in order for that to be successful. It's actually just a link between the two.
Financial literacy is not a waste of money. That's another thing I wish people would stop. It's not a waste of money. And financial education is not a waste of money. That's another thing. I think it has to be moved from the term financial literacy because it's being paired with the poor, right? And yep. Financial education is a broader scope. So I think if you, and there's a lot of play on words here and people saying that, but there's a new study that has come out to show that there's effectiveness with financial education. And to your point, our business spends a lot of time on the middle E because we want to prove how smart we are, but no one cares until you actually get proximate to their situation and what it is that they're going through, right? So much so, $17 billion spent on marketing financial services, less than 1% on education. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. And to be fair, you know, to Jennifer and her quote, I believe her exact quote was, it has been a failure. And I think it's because of what you said.
Yes. 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 Right. Agree. We agree there. Yes, it has.
I don't want Jennifer coming after me, you know, that I misrepresented her quote.
It has been.
And so when we think of the on-ramp to help better educate and support and actually make it effective, let's talk, since you are a financial advisor, do we attack spend first? Do we attack wealth? What do you think those first missing essential pieces are that we need time to get out? Is what?
Time and proximity.
Okay.
So I've been imploring financial advisors to do this. They're CFP board, CFA mm-hmm. Institute. There is no reason why those of us with all of these fancy licenses and designations should not be required to give up at least an hour of our time weekly, monthly, whatever, to give back to these programs that then go into the community to educate people. So one is time. The other thing is I cannot diagnose and or help you unless I get proximate to your condition. I have to know exactly what it is that you are struggling with. You may not know what a maiden name is, but yet here I am talking about backdoor Roth RA contributions, right?
Yeah.
You could be struggling with the difference between a debit and a credit on your statement. You don't understand that. But yet I'm trying to convince you of the difference between an ETF and a mutual fund. So until we get into communities that actually need the help, then we aren't going to be able to give the qualified advice. So time and proximity is one. And then yes, once we've identified the problem, we go back to BlackRock, Blackstone, Merrill, Goldman, all these other people that are, putting up all this money now, and we shine a light on Detroit, We shine a light on Chicago. We shine a light on, you know, Broward County in Florida. We shine a light on Camden and Irvington and Newark in New Jersey. Then we bring the resources in because we know exactly how to impact the problem. And then we also make sure that we're starting as early as possible, right? 21 states in the country require financial literacy to be taught in high schools. I believe only 11 of them require that, provide the education, the training, and the resources to do it. So there's a lot here, but we just have to get into the weeds and understand where the problem is, shine a light on it, and then go attack it with time, proximity, and money.
What role do you think fintech can play here? Do you see the same structural issues when we look at whether it be the robo-advisors or the advice sites? How can, I know you're a fintech fan and a tech nerd, where should this be playing into being part of the solution?
It is, see, it's tricky because I have to be careful here. This is why I love crypto so much. I've never been more bullish on crypto and Bitcoin than I am right now because of how it's going to free the millions of people in this country that have been shut out of the legacy financial system. But there's also a digital divide in this country, right? There's a divide between people who understand fintech and those that have access to it. So I have to be careful there because the people that I fight for aren't aware of some of these tools, but go no farther than Cash App. Cash App is, I mean, we could spend a day on Cash App. What a beautiful tool that is to give people bank accounts, to allow them direct deposit, to give them access to Bitcoin, to allow them access to fractional shares of stock. It is incredible. And they provide wonderful educational tools. So fintech is going to play a role here, but we also have to understand there are some people who, again, just shut out from that. And we're going to have to bring them into this new world, teach them how to use these apps, what it means to have a bank account and all of these things. But I do think fintech plays a major role here. And when crypto goes mainstream, lights out.
So last question, your parting shot. What is the key takeaway that someone like me, what can I do to better support advisors like you and your people of all colors, but especially in Black communities like this? What can we be doing a better job of? I shouldn't say we, me specifically. What role would you want me to be playing?
Simply identification and networking. So you doing this, reaching out to me, is probably the most powerful thing that you can do. Because like you said, when you emailed me, you let me know, like, this is a really big show and we reach a very large audience. To someone to turn this on and to see my name and hear Tyrone and hear my inflection and how I pronounce words and how I speak, that is massive. You have no idea what that means. So leveraging your platform and giving it up to people with different names and different backgrounds and different cultures is huge. This is the biggest thing you can do, because I say this all the time to the biggest names in our industry, Josh Brown and Ron Carson. I said to Ron Carson yesterday, your megaphone is huge. It doesn't need to be your cause, but if you just say, here, Tyrone, scream about whatever it is that you want to scream about, here's 30 minutes, here's 25 minutes on my show. So this means everything to me, my family, my mentees, and to anyone who is listening and go, oh my God, that person sounds like me, that person looks like me. So this is the biggest thing you can do. The other thing is just simply, when this is off, and you can advocate for somebody, that a Black boy or a Black girl or, you know, someone that's, again, now you did get into Black and Brown, just simply give them an opportunity. Is it passing on a resume? Is it reaching out to Jason Wank and saying, hey, take a look at this kid. He's super talented. Didn't necessarily go to, you know, Yale, but man, could he code, right? Man, does he really understand markets? Because again, that's how I got here. Never took a business, accounting, finance class. First high school graduate, got kicked out of college. And now I'm 14 years into Wall Street. Like, I'm only here because people gave me a shot. So I think you giving me a shot to do this and then giving other people a shot to use your tremendous network, that is the most powerful thing you can do. It's not diversity and inclusion episodes. It's not diversity and inclusion panels. It's behind the scenes networking, putting people in position to be successful like you did with me here. And I appreciate you for it. I'm humbled and grateful.
Well, if you want to hear more of Tyrone, he has a great podcast called the Human Advisor Podcast. A great way, especially if you're an advisor and you want to look into the business. I love the conversations you have with advisors. Where can they find the Human Advisor Podcast?
Human Advisor podcast is located on YouTube at the Altruist YouTube page and also the humanadvisorpodcast.com. You can find all of the episodes there housed with the visual and the audio.
Thanks for joining us today, Tyrone, and thanks for the passion you brought.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.